namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddham dhammam sanghaṃ sāmi. I've been traveling since mid-December, so I'm not quite in Australia yet. It's sort of interesting watching my mind, it's sort of in a pleasant kind of confused state. You know, I was doing the walking meditation waiting for the bell to ring. Like, this seems like a long time. They come back, everyone's sitting there. So, I'm not quite with the retreat, but I'm giving it a go. The joy of this practice is that you can look at yourself and, you know, it's okay to be confused. I've been a monk for 38 years and I'm still trying to figure out how to get here. So a sense of humor is invaluable. So what was the theme of the retreat? That's selfless service and as a path to happiness, yeah?
Yes.
Let's go back to one of the themes that I seem to dwell on a lot. The idea of reflection as opposed to, say, belief. So in our monastic training, when we begin as monastics, one of the basic training principles is to be content with little. So we reflect on our alms food as being something that's offered by the laity, and the idea is it's good enough to take you through for the day, rather than have the very best food or special food or whatever. Robes, good enough to cover the body according to the tradition. A kuti or sannyasa, a place to stay, good enough to shelter from the weather and allow you to be free from the intrusion of animals and such like. Medicine, good enough to take care of the body. So there's this kind of attitude to just be content, learn how to practice contentment with simple offerings, simple requisites. And so going back to the idea of belief and reflection, say when I started as a monk or a novice in Wapapong in Thailand, the food was very, very simple, extremely simple, and it was the way it was dished out was all the curries were dumped into one huge pot. All the sweets were dumped into another huge pot. Two monks would carry these pots and just ladle it into your bowl. We were 50 monks. Plop, 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 plop. And then there'd be fruit and the rice. This was very, very basic. And when Ajahn Chah was there, it was basic. And when he wasn't there, it was more basic. So it was very basic. For me, coming into the monastery, I've been traveling for 3 years and just doing my own thing. Lived in India a year and a half. And I had access to any kind of food I wanted, within reason, most of the time. And so I also had access to music and to all kinds of other sense distractions. So when I got to the monastery, all of a sudden all the sense distractions that I was used to, I didn't have available. Living celibate, not having music, not having much literature, oftentimes not having anyone who could speak English. So the outlets for my sense experiences were now extremely limited so much so that it was just one meal a day and plop, plop, plop into my bowl. So all of a sudden the range of sense possibilities I had limited to one meal a day, and the meal was very simple. And all of a sudden I just uncovered I had food issues. You know, I wanted yogurt, or I wanted an apple pie with ice cream, or whatever my mind brought up. And that was interesting. Because when I just had access to food when I wanted it, then oh, I've got no food issues, I can eat anything. And then all of a sudden, this kind of limitation. And then also the limitation of having other sense avenues. So that sensual greed became heightened around just a simple meal. So I found myself being jealous if another monk got a bigger mango than me, or irritated if they had a bigger banana or something like that. And in my mind I could see this is silly, grow up. But the greed mind was very real, because now it was kind of highly focused onto just one thing. So it was quite edifying, it was quite instructive. But going back to contentment as belief, or contentment as reflection, so the reflective part of contentment was asking me to look at my mind and train in contentment. So I bring up contentment with little as a mirror. But what my mind was doing was not content. I want more, I want different, I don't want this, I don't want that. And so reflection on content with little helped me to see discontent. It didn't put an end to the discontent by any means, but it helped me to see the discontent. And then as my mind tried to would pick up the discontent and go into thoughts around it, I said, no, that's not the training. The training isn't in discontent. The training is in contentment. So the mirror and the reminder of contentment with a little became a kind of helpful way for me to awaken to discontent. And then if I could awaken to discontent, as my mind started to flow in that negative direction, I'd say, no, not there. It's good enough. And then my mind would complain, no, it's good enough. So that is different than believing that I should be content. Now, if I would have picked up that idea that a young novice from Western culture who's never been trained should be content, I should be content, then that would have become a kind of inner cruelty, inner tyranny, a demand, Vrindavan, you should be content. And that would then create this incredible conflict with discontent. And then I'd feel guilty, or I'd try to suppress it, or I'd try to falsely, oh yes, this is lovely, which would be a kind of BS, wouldn't it? and that's sometimes the danger in any spiritual practice, is we have these fixed ideas of how it should be, and then there's a reality how it is, and then we feel guilty. And we feel self-critical and self-disparaging. Whereas reflective teaching, there's just these helpful mirrors to see, well, how is it now? And the way it is it skillful? Is it unskillful? If it's unskillful, maybe I shouldn't follow that track. And then the idea of training and craft, so the discontent would come up, the reminder of chanting and the teaching and the ajans and so on, and now you're training in contentment. So then I'd say, oh, this is discontent. So first of all, I'd feel, oh, discontent feels this way. So the training in awareness feels this way. Get to know it rather than believe in it. Feels this way. Feels uncomfortable. It's suffering. And then as my mind would think that, it'd say, no, it's good enough. It's good enough. And then over time, that kind of training in awareness of discontent, awareness that discontent is not a state of mind which leads to peace or happiness, seeing the logic of learning how to let go of it, moving the mind to gratitude and contentment, over time, little by little, the mind began to change, and I sincerely began to see the beauty of contentment, not as an ideal which I tried to impose on myself, but rather as a reality of training the mind. And in that contentment, I began to see how much suffering discontent was, and began to see the logic, oh, it's good enough, this is good enough, and the logic of gratitude. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't crave other things, when, you know, that was just a craving mind. But now I could see that's just craving. This craving feels this way, be mindful of craving. And then the energy of craving then no longer was so deluding. Living in a physical body, it still has craving. It's just the way these bodies function, isn't it? So that's a theme that I always find to be very important, the difference between a reflective teaching or belief teaching and the idea of training rather than idealizing of how it should be. And notice how when you attach to ideals about yourself or others, how terribly painful that is. I should be, you know, Ajahn Viradharma, I should at least come on time. or not spill my soup or whatever I do. But that kind of holding to an ideal and then comparing the reality to that ideal is often a kind of inner cruelty that we put on ourselves. It's not kind. It's not benevolent. It's not goodwill. It's ill will. So attaching to ideals as opposed to reflecting on ideals is different. Reflecting on ideals, ideals are good. I mean, you need to have an idea of what a good practice would be about. These are fine. But reflecting on them, using them as mirrors to become a more profound person. That is the way, the authentic way, a useful, fruitful way of a Buddhist practice. So in terms of self-service and happiness and so on, we all live lives of both a social reality and an inner reality. You know, I have my social reality is that I'm male, I have a male body, I'm 65 years old, I have responsibilities in Canada, I have friends throughout the world, I have a personal history, I have appointments, I have an airline ticket, etc., etc., etc. That's my social reality that I live in. And that is the reality which we call Viradharma. And then there's the inner reality, the changing inner response to this outer reality of like or dislike, of tiredness or irritation, of peacefulness and joy or boredom, the kind of inner movement of inner consciousness. And we both have these two realities that we live by, and these realities are always reacting to each other. So if I'm in a very bright and upbeat mood, I go outside, I see more beauty. I see the beauty of the sky, I see the beauty of the trees. If I'm going through some very difficult karma, or I've had a very terrible argument with someone, then my inner world consumes me more. I don't notice the trees, I don't notice the blue sky, I'm more consumed by it. If I'm frightened, my inner world is one of fear, I look at you as a threat. If my inner world is one of relaxation and compassion, I look at you as a friend, and so on and so forth. So these two are always sort of interplaying, interacting. And then in terms of self-service, if we have an opportunity to serve, that's the kind of social reality that we are functioning in. And then the inner reality is what we try to train with. I have a friend, he's died now, but he had on his mantle, he was very eclectic, on his mantelpiece he had a picture of Mother Teresa, Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna, Lopacha, and Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi is a great Indian saint, Ramakrishna is a great Indian saint, and most of you would know Mother Teresa. And he said, when he looks at the picture of Mother Teresa, that's his karma yogi, one who does service. When he looks at Ramakrishna, that's his bhakti yogi. Bhakti is the idea of devotion, devotional practice. Ramakrishna was a great Indian saint that lived at the turn of the last century, the 1800s to 1900s in Calcutta. He was an interesting spiritual being. And then you look at take a picture of Ajahn Chah and Ramana Maharshi and say those are his Jnana yogis or wisdom yogis. So we come from a kind of wisdom practice where we stress wisdom, insight, and we tend to stress samadhi, the development of concentration practices. But also in our social, you know, in our social lives, we come up to the kind of ideas of karma yogi. When Mother Teresa, I read once, and she was complimented on having started so many hospices for the dying in India, that they helped so many dying people die a more dignified death and a more peaceful death. She said, "Well, I didn't create these hospices for the people who are dying. I created it for the nuns." And that's a switch, isn't it? So she created a situation where the nuns could serve, where they could make their spiritual practice one of serving the dying. The kind of reversal of how we usually look at it. Now, our tradition isn't so much focused on karma yoga in that way, but all of us are called upon to somehow extend ourselves. And so one of the considerations, I think, which is helpful in spiritual practices, rather than what can I get, because when we always talk about attainment in terms of the four stages of enlightenment, or we talk about attainment of the various deep states of concentration, there tends to be a kind of mindset which is always trying to get something, achieve something. Which isn't bad, but it can, it's pretty easy to see how the mind then would become future-oriented, grasping, trying to get something, trying to become something. And yet the teaching, when you look at the aspects around craving, the letting go of craving, it's about non-becoming, about letting go, relinquishment, abandonment, this kind of language we find. So kind of a good question to put oneself is what do I need to let go of, or what do I need to give up, or what aspect is in terms of self-sacrifice? What do I need to let go of or give up in order to be peaceful, rather than being like peace being something I get through a lot of willful effort? So it's another way of looking at it. Obviously, I need to make effort, and you can see how quite simply, maybe I have a certain expectation of the retreat being a certain way, a certain level of silence, a certain diet, a certain routine or whatever, and then I come to the retreat and I find the external reality is different. You know, it's not quite what I expected, teacher isn't saying what I wanted, and there's not enough coffee or whatever you have, right? Now, obviously, I have to let go of that bit of expectation if I'm going to be peaceful. I have to let go of something in order to come to a peaceful state of mind. That's a kind of gross example. So, in the living of a life, in the living of our social reality, we are, you know, whether I'm taking care of my mother or I'm just going to work or whatever, we're inevitably frustrated by life. Something comes up that does not suit our desire patterns. That's ordinary. And one of the... when Ajahn Chah apparently was asked what his method was. What is your method, Ompa Chah? Do you teach Anapanasati? Do you teach Metta? He'd say, no, my method is frustration. And, you know, having lived with him, I can see what he was pointing to. Now that was cruel, but... when done skillfully, you've probably heard of many stories of Ajahn Chah. The classic ones were all, one of them was this long Dharma talks. And all of us who practice at Ompa Chah have our Dharma talk stories. And when I was just in Thailand, and I heard other monks talking about stories, and I was like, oh yeah, I was there that time. It's funny about memory, you kind of think, did that really happen? It's so long ago, and then I heard the story, it did happen. So, say, when Ajahn Chah had a lot of energy, he could talk for 6 hours. You know, and you know, how much of Four Noble Truths can you take in 6 hours? I just like, oh, no more. And so the classic one, I think, I think Rinpo Chandi was talking about this. We've gathered for the Patimokkha, which is our fortnightly recitation of the rules, which is a very serious occasion and very formal, kind of very high church kind of occasion. And I guess that would have been around 8 o'clock or so, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And we went through the formalities, and someone chanted the Patimokkha, and then Rinpo Cha would often give a Dhamma talk. And so we're sitting there, maybe 30 monks, and he starts to give a Dhamma talk, and 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 give a Dhamma talk. And now, so imagine me, this kind of junior novice monk character, who knows a bit of Thai. Yeah. When I first landed in Awakapong, I had a book called Fundamentals of Thai, and it took me about 6 months to realize I was speaking Lao. I'm not very quick. Anyway, so sitting here, and Ajahn Chah's talking, and so concrete floor, right, no cushion, just your little sitting cloth, a language I don't understand, heat and mosquitoes, and this voice droning on, just going on and on and on. And it doesn't take long to reach that point of frustration. And then, yeah, what do I teach? I teach frustration. So now the social reality is this now. I'm in this room. I'm with a very famous teacher, and I'm feeling frustrated. So I could just leave. No one ever left. I mean, that would be. It just wouldn't leave. But I could have just left and go on and so on. No. This is what I have to surrender to. This is the form, this is the structure that my teacher has asked me to practice in. And then what's he saying in the talk, even if I didn't understand directly the words, what's he saying is, why do you suffer? And I was saying, because you won't shut up. That's the true cause of my suffering. And I'm being facetious, but the real cause is I don't want to be here now. And my mom would say, I want to go meditate. Right? This isn't meditation. I have to fidgeting all the time, and the posture is terrible, and I could do, mind going on and on. And Rinpo Cha would be talking. And you just keep kind of saying, what's the cause of suffering? In the beginning, you'd be angry and annoyed and say, well, what is the cause of suffering? And you'd bring up the Four Noble Truths. That definitely was suffering. There was no doubt about that. So the first noble truth was there. There is suffering. This I am suffering. But it wasn't life-threatening. I couldn't say that, that I was going to die in the next hour, although I felt like it. This is not life-threatening, so it's okay. And the man's benevolent, since he's trying to teach himself. The other monks seem to be surviving. And so what's the cause of suffering? Well, after giving up blame, and taking responsibility, the cause of suffering is, I don't want this situation, I want another situation, obviously. So here I am, I'm trapped into a situation, and I'm deliberately frustrated by the situation, and that's very helpful. And it's very edifying because it's repeated many evenings. This is going to happen to you again, very normal. If you don't learn this now, you're going to have to learn it eventually. So, taking responsibility. Oh, I want things to be other than they are. What does it really feel like to suffer? Understanding suffering, first of all. What does it really feel like? This moment, I don't feel it very well. And now all of a sudden, oh, it's this way. You kind of awaken again, rather than the mind just going on complaining and groaning. It's this way. And you begin to see the arising of wanting not to be here. The arising of that it's not permanent. And then I went, it's this way now. Listen to the cicadas. Feel the pain. What's the pain really like before you grumble? And then you see that the desire ceases. Huh. And then it comes up again, because the hip's hurting or whatever, and Ajahn Chah is just talking. And then one of the more lonely moments would be when Ajahn Chah would crack a joke. So we're like 2 hours into this piece, and he cracks a joke, and everyone laughs. I don't understand the joke. So I feel even more lonely. Right? And but again, it's like this is suffering. Yeah, I know. But what's the cause? You kind of wake, as you wake up to suffering, the cause falls away because you're awake, you're aware. And then it churns up again. I don't want to be here. I don't know how long is this going to go on? Ah, there it is. That's desire arising. That's desire arising. And then I notice it, and then the desire falls away again. I begin to see that suffering is directly related to craving, and that the craving is not permanent. It begins and it ends. It begins and it ends. And you actually see the ending of it, not through suppression or denial or distraction or compensation, through just awareness. And you begin to focus on what is the cause of suffering? What is it? And this is now not an analytical process. And here we go back to reflection and belief. If I take it as a belief, you know, that there is suffering, there is a cause and so on, that's not a reflection. Reflection is like the mirror saying, well, you're suffering, mate. Why? Where is it? And you kind of look and investigate, and all of a sudden you see, oh, it's craving. And you see it cease. And so after doing that for many, many months or whatever, begin to see that like you anticipate, oh God, how long is a man going to talk? I love him, yeah, but not 6 hours. And you see anticipation arising before one of these sessions. Oh, what is suffering? This is suffering, anticipating, wanting or expecting, and not wanting something negative. And that's a kind of beautiful practice, because it's an awakened practice, and it shows the real cause of suffering was. So this particular night, Lord Pocha was going on, and me and these fortnightly sessions, the tradition was to meditate right through till 3 in the morning, then do morning chanting, then prepare for altar and go on altar, and so basically you didn't sleep. And the beauty of it, the beautiful part, was they brought coffee at 12 o'clock. And this is why you stayed up to 12. So, Rupa Chan's talking, and the lay people, the lay stewards, bring in 3 big, massive pots of coffee, steaming coffee. And everyone's eyes just go over to the coffee, and Rupa Chan just keeps talking. And, you know, so there's the elation of the coffee arising, and then he keeps talking and talking. And the elation goes to depression. I'm not going to do anything. And he did that. He just talked. And I don't know whatever happened to that coffee. But then it was 3 o'clock. Then it was time for chanting. Did the chanting and went off to Armstrong. Now, you just think of the fortitude of this man, that he could take on 30 monks who are probably shooting daggers at him. Because why? Because, well, it was actually a very kind thing to do, to set up a situation to frustrate us in a kind of good-humored way, where we could really learn about the Four Noble Truths in a way which was very, very edifying, because it wasn't threatening. We could leave any time we wanted. We trusted him, but we were frustrated. And so you watch, and then you begin to get the sense of honor. No, I'm going to sit through this and not whine, not whinge. Sure, I feel discomfort, but I'm going to try to practice letting go. What do I have to give up now? I have to give up wanting this situation to be according to my desires and my desire patterns. And a kind of nobility arises, rather than the childlike mind, the adolescent mind, complaining and so on. There's a kind of virility or energy arises. No, the teacher wants me to do this, practice this, go for it. And that kind of determination and a sense of manly honor kind of for me is a very, very energizing state of mind, where obviously the complaining and the moaning and so on is a very de-energizing, depressing kind of state of mind. But that doesn't happen just by believing it, does it? Just by saying that it's a nice story, it brings a few laughs and so on. But the actual doing of it is what we mean by training. So all of us have those kinds of social situations that arise that would challenge God. And if we can bring up that this place of practice is the moment, the frustration of desire is edifying, it can teach you something. The frustration of desire is the place where we develop the virtuous qualities such as patience, endurance, honesty, compassion, determination, equanimity, all kinds of powerful states of mind. We don't develop patience when we get what we want. You know, when everything is going well, you don't have to be patient, obviously. But when you don't get what you want, you're frustrated, then that's where you develop the kind of strength of the mind. Now, why is that important? Well, because it's very hard for us to stay in the moment. It's very hard for us to just stay in the mind which is free from thought. It's very hard for us to not just always project into the future and go to the past. We're always creating a self. We're always creating a personal history. And then we're always struggling with something through like and dislike and fear. So to have a type of consciousness which has a kind of strength to be really, really stable with whatever's going on, pain or pleasure, to be really, really still and grounded with whatever's going on, that takes a kind of development, what we call bhavana. And so being, say, for me, being frustrated like that, or having to just be with very, very kind of coarse and rough food, was tremendously helpful, because I had to learn how to just be patient more, be more accepting, be more content. And then that, over the years, you build up a foundation for enlightenment. And that foundation is what? It's just like a really stable mind. When the conditions change, the mind just doesn't wimp out and react. And the mind has this kind of stability. And that's a kind of way to look at practice, which isn't just about trying to gain some kind of very high attainment, to have a more kind of humble approach, to say that this situation, just like in a sitting practice, say, if you get too idealistic and you think you want some deep state of absorption or whatever, that's very fine to shoot for that, but maybe this sitting that you're going through is the time just to be more patient with discomfort, which was a much more humble undertaking. When we were our first year at in Thailand at Wat Nai Chat, we had some very, you know, there was Ajahn Pasando and Ajahn Anando and Ajahn Pavagro and myself, and Ajahn Brahm was there, and Ajahn, you know, all these kind of well-known monks were there, and we were pretty high-powered, determined bunch of fellows. And one day Ajahn Samir said, "Well, you know, you guys are trying so hard. Why don't you just be an earthworm?" He also said, "Hell bent on getting enlightened. Why don't you just learn to be an earthworm? You just go through the soil and aerate the soil. Just one day at a time, just a bit of dirt at a time." And you know, in his facetious way, he was just kind of just pointing to the kind of over-determination in which we were all involved in, just trying so hard to get something, become something. And that's one of the banes of practice, is this kind of willful attempt to get rid of the bad and get the good. So willfulness, when it's misdirected, gives a very unhappy result. But the use of intention and training and being determined, definitely, you have to be determined in this work. You know, you have to really, really stick at it. But it's not a willful attempt to become something. It's more kind of a humble willingness to train in just the ordinary, just to kind of the question we had earlier about the mind, the body which was still and wasn't thinking, which I thought sounded pretty good actually. But perhaps in the answer which I came up later was, well, perhaps sometimes you get states of mind which are really ho-hum, ordinary, nothing much. And then you think, well, I should be getting something. You know, I should be getting something in my practice. And then just that very ordinary state of mind, just being present, nothing much about it, it seems to be so bland. It's not bright and starry and so on. So a desire from some kind of memory comes up. I should be getting something. And it's the very desire which we need to look at. It's the cessation of craving which we need to look at. And the cessation of craving quite often means that you allow yourself to feel like it's nothing special. It's just this way. It's this way now. You allow yourself not to know. The mind wants to have an answer quite often. So one of the difficulties with a highly intellectual culture is we just seek answers in thought. And the problem with that is for one answer you get another question. The classic thing that people ask monks is, how does rebirth work? You know, what's the mechanism of rebirth? And so, you know, the person gets an answer and then they just ask the next monk the same question for 40 years. Because we don't know. We don't know. And so like when you don't know, the intellect doesn't like that. It likes answers. It likes definite, crisp, clear answers. But the intellect is a limited thing. It's not perfect. It's limited. So that's just things like not being sure. Well, this is a feeling of not being sure. I'm not sure, feels this way. The craving mind wants to be sure, but it's okay to feel doubt. The doubt feels this way. I'm not sure. Or confusion. Or grayness. All these more nebulous states of mind. Quite often when you have like strong passion, anger, fear, it's pretty obvious. You go to the body and feel until it runs its course. It's kind of obvious. But more subtle things like doubt, not being sure, confusion, these kinds of things. You think you have to do something about it. But in terms of mindfulness, it's not the object of your experience. It's not the emotion or the thought pattern. It's the craving around it. No object can satisfy craving. No object, no sight, no sound, no taste, no bodily feeling, no emotion, no relationship there. They're always very ephemeral, very subject to change and other conditions. So it's the cessation of craving we're interested in rather than the particular type of object. So we're not looking for an experience, a high experience or an exalted experience, because all experience is conditioned. It's tentative, it's dependent. But what is independent? What is not dependent on other conditions? Well, the way we realize that is we begin to watch change. Now, in this kind of reflective capacity that we have, any card-carrying Buddhist will tell you that which has a nature to arise is a nature to cease. That's a belief. It's not a wrong belief. That's a position. That's an intellectual position. But to actually have the presence of mind to step back and notice how conditions are changing, that's a different attitude. That's quite hard to do because our attention is so much caught up with objects, caught up with emotions, caught up with memories, caught up with bodily feelings, with sounds. Our attention is always kind of going out, going out, going out. But to actually come back home and notice change. Like if I asked you now, if we go back to this listening exercise, if I asked you just to listen and notice change, and even let go of sound, just notice change. Well, what I have to do, I have to take my attention away from all objects and just notice change, and my mind goes very silent. Notice change. Notice in that, there's no craving. I'm not saying you have to change anything. You don't have to get everything. But you have to let go of thought and step back to a kind of aware state of mind which knows the way things are. Now that's a reflective exercise. And then what does craving do? If you look at craving is always trying to reorganize things to get a different objective experience. Happier, sadder, more comfortable, more beautiful, less angry, and so on and so forth. But to take something like it, say if you feel jealous. Jealousy is not a very nice emotion. And it comes up into consciousness that just to say, now, what's the changing nature of jealousy? And that means you have to step back, still know the jealousy because it's there, but just to step back and see it change, rather than try to do something and rearrange it to your ideal pattern of non-jealousy, I shouldn't be jealous, or believe in it and project it onto people and hate them. That's different. So that's a very powerful reflection, and that's what we call anicca sanya, or the recollection of change, and that's one of the perceptions the Buddha was asking us to be mindful of. When we talk about mindfulness, we don't just mean sort of a functional mindfulness where I walk carefully so that I don't spill the milk on the floor. Sure, I mean, that we do, or don't break my leg on the rocks. But more profoundly, the Buddha asked us to bring up certain perceptions, which he said would be very, very skillful if you could do this. So said, the perception of change. And so that requires kind of memory, to remember to do that. And then to hold your mind in a sense of noticing change, that's difficult. Because the craving mind is always judging, trying to get rid of, and struggling. So to come back and to notice change. But I think it's pretty clear, if I just ask you, stop thinking, right, and notice change, listen. Your mind goes silent, doesn't it? It's just there. If you're thinking, then you're not noticing change. If you're trying to figure it out, if you're analyzing, if you're calm at all. But at any split moment, you can just stop, listen, notice change. And that's hard to do, but it gets you to a kind of way of knowing life where you're not grasping, you're just knowing change. And that's the doorway to the most peaceful states of mind, that kind of silence which isn't dependent on objects. It's a training, it's something you really need to remember to do, and you need to experiment with rather than just believe or disbelieve. So when we're developing meditation, it's very hard just to stay in this kind of very open awareness of change. So usually we pick up an object of meditation, like the breath, say. But the whole point of it is to cultivate a certain state of mind which can know change. It's not like you're going anywhere. You're always coming home to that stillness. And in that stillness, you begin to see you have to let go of something. I have to give up comfort. I have to give up give up knowing, even like having some kind of intellectual clarity. Just give up. Just keep letting go into the silence. It's a very subtle kind of training. When I started meditation, I was very willful, and I terribly willful, just like really foolishly willful, so much so that I pushed like the sleep envelope, and I'd be walking out. I was so tired that at the end of the walking path, walking all night, I'd fall asleep and collapse. I wouldn't go to sleep, and I'd get up and walk again. And that was just like pure willpower and lacking in intelligence and wisdom. So I learned my lesson, and Ajahn Chah just said, take it easy. But that sometimes we're blinded like that. So I was quite blinded by my own willfulness and my own idealism. And this is much more subtle. It's not an act of willful becoming. It's more like a gentle remembering and letting go. And it's much more subtle. And so one of the things that we try to watch is the willfulness of our practice. So we're trying to get something or get rid of something. And these are two aspects of craving. Bhavatana, vibhavatana. Bhavatana is the sense of becoming. I'm inadequate, I need to become something else. And vibhavatana is trying to get rid of. I have to get rid of this, I shouldn't be like this. And they're both aspects of discontent, suffering. Whereas the mindfulness practices, it feels this way now. This discontent feels this way now. This pain or whatever, it's just this way now. So you're returning to home base. You return to your true home, and then when you come back to home, then you try to be the witness of change, rather than being the author that always has to change things. The witness, knowing change. That's always very close. It's not that far. That when we pick up our objects of meditation, that's what we're trying to cultivate: this capacity to know change, But we focus on an object because it's much easier to do. But not to get rid of or become, simply to cultivate this kind of inner sense of stillness. Okay, I'll offer that for reflection. I'll just look at some questions here. Sometimes when I am carefully using a meditation object to focus on present moment awareness, I sense thoughts happening in the background. The content is not clear. It's as if they're muffled, like a background noise that's hard to make out. Yeah, it's the... Well, like sound, it can be a background, can't it? It's the sound of the crickets or cicadas or whatever. And, I think you just, the more one can, like, whatever, these kinds of things, whatever happens, just recognize it, okay? This is a feeling of background thought. And don't make it a problem. Just make the mind more and more clear with suchness. And the way you sometimes do that is you just make the object of meditation more obvious. You bring more attention to it. And what I like to do is I like to just specifically go to no thought. Deliberately go with no thought. The end of a thought. So sometimes you can take a thought and think it deliberately. Tomorrow is Monday. No thought. Because sometimes we can be kind of half thinking, half meditating. But the first and foremost thing is to say, well, there is thought, or it feels this way now, to really make the mind bright with awareness. And then try something. But always try from clarity rather than desire. Bring the mind to clarity first. This is who it is now. And then experiment. So that in this question you can experiment with just bringing the mind to no thought. So you kind of let go of the meditation object, just no thought. Or you focus on the object. You know, kind of experiment, see how it works. All of us will have questions like this. And the answer to the question is usually through experimenting. Just try stuff out. Just try to think deliberately or focus more strongly on the object. Yeah. But generally, if we're trying to develop some samadhi, we need to really pay attention to the object of meditation and just stay with that. Whatever peripheral things come, not to get bothered by it, just to stay with the object of meditation. And the kind of bored and doubtful mind will pick up things like this and start to think, I wonder what that is. I wonder what I should be doing about that. Well, basically stop thinking. So doubt is a kind of mind state that comes up and you just sort of mull things over. And you get kind of altered states of consciousness and all kinds of things happen in meditation. But you just keep it very simple, stay with the object of meditation, and the peripheral stuff, don't let it distract you. Don't make it important. It's just peripheral. Don't make it an issue. So you're just very, very still, very centralized. I'll have a look at these tomorrow in the light. So let's close with the usual chanting.
Arahama Samma Sambhujo Bhagavā Udham Bhagavantam Abhivade. Svākāto Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammamasam. Supatipanno Bhagavato Asam.